Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm happy to have as my guest Moshe Kasher. This is a real first for Bookworm. I've spoken to some of the most prominent intellectuals in America and in the world, but I've never before spoken to a stand-up comedian. He's the author of Kasher in the Rye. I happened to be down at the wonderfully reopened Uncabaret. You know, it's Sunday nights at 8 o'clock down at First and Hope, and I thought this guy was so hilarious, and then when it turned out he had a book, I just couldn't resist. Now tell me, with both parents being deaf, and one of them an Orthodox Jew, the other abducting you to live in Oakland, and for punishment being sent back to the Orthodox sections of, is it Brooklyn?
Sure, yeah. It's the deepest of pre-Nazi war Brooklyn, the shtetl, the set of Yentl, as I call it, yeah.
And was this a recipe for disaster? I mean, did everyone around you know that you were going to be trouble?
Well, I think that's one, that's one of the themes in the book, is this idea that I don't know, I keep chicken or egging through this entire book. How did I go down this path? Was it because I was preordained by circumstance, or was it because my mom kept looking for something to be wrong with me so long that finally we were both lucky enough to find something deeply, deeply wrong with me? I think that, yeah, my childhood was a fertile ground with deep seeds of trouble laid into it from birth, definitely.
And as I understand it, not from the book, but from your routines, your mom was very encouraging of certain kinds of liberation, but not of others.
Oh, that's for sure, yeah. My mom was one of these boundaryless parents of the 60s who'd come up. Her parent, you know, her mother was, you know, from the 40s, 50s era where we just don't talk about that. And my mom was decidedly, we will talk about everything, whether it makes you horribly uncomfortable or not. And so it was quite a boundaryless household. There's a part in the book where I talk about the nights of sexual education that my mom would sort of enforce on us. And at the end of every session, she would ask us, now, are you two boys gay? And we would say, no, Mom. But we really got the impression that she really wished we were. You know, she really, if there's such a thing of being too supportive, my mother had it. Yeah.
And your mom and your grandma were both feminists, as I gather.
Yeah, they were definitely, I say they border on man-hating, you know, except for, you know, the message in our household was all men are pigs, except you two boys, you're good boys. And so that was the sort of the world that I lived in. And of course, then I went home to my father's to find that he had joined up back with the original patriarchy, you know, the biblical patriarchy. So I was living in an extremely schizophrenic and bifurcated world that I couldn't make sense of myself. And so I think, you know, I found the way out, which was to check out.
And he had it a little bit easy because he was deaf. The people in the Orthodox community didn't know that he didn't know Hebrew or Yiddish. Do I have this right?
Yeah, that's more or less correct. You know, my father was a great fan of aesthetics. You know, he was an artist. Before he jumped into religiosity, he was a painter and he was a beatnik and he was a textile designer in Manhattan. And my mother and my father, they lived in this very, unstable world together, but they were beatniks and weirdo artists, and according to family legend, Marcel Marceau asked my father to come on the road with him to be his acolyte, and my father would, because my father was this great performative man because he was deaf, and maybe that's part of where I get my performative nature from. And so he loved when he did get religious, he loved the aesthetics of Orthodox Judaism. He loved the stark black and white nature of everything. Here's the hat that we wear. Here are the shirts that we wear. Everything was old-fashioned and beautiful. But other than the aesthetics of it, he didn't have an incredible intellectual hold on it. Not because he wasn't an intelligent man, but just because, you know, there's not a lot of access within the incredibly ultra-Orthodox Hasidic world for the deaf. Yeah.
So you have a set of choices. You can be a homosexual child, you can be an Orthodox Jew,
right.
Or you can be a gangster.
Yeah, so which do I choose?
Well, tell us.
I mean, well, what happened for me was, I think that what happened was all of these things served to make me feel other. So I had these two deaf parents and no one else had deaf parents. I had this Hasidic Jewish father and no one in Oakland had any experience with that. And when I would fly back home to Brooklyn, I would essentially and literally pretend to be a Hasidic Jew for 6 weeks a year. I would sort of shuck and jive and hope that they liked me. I didn't know what was happening there either. And I would come back home to this house where it was all women that hated men. And I felt other all the time. I was put in therapy when I was 4 years old and special education from the time I was about 8 years old. Everything served to make me feel like a sore thumb sticking out of the world. And so the path that I chose was when I found drugs and alcohol, at 12 years old, it might sound a little bit young to the listeners, but for me, it had been high time that I found a way out of my own brain. And the moment that I got high and drunk for the first time, all of the other went away and I was like completely here and now and just accepted myself as I was, which is a singular experience, I think, for the drug addict and alcoholic, which is everybody loves getting high and drinking. It feels good. It feels pleasant. But when it's the first thing that's ever made you feel okay in your life, that's when you plunge in and become a troubled user, I think.
Which leads us to the complete title of the book, which is Casher in the Rye, The True Tale of a White Boy from Oakland Who Became a Drug Addict, Criminal, Mental Patient, and then turned 16.
That's a mouthful, huh?
Well, it's interesting because these experiences when you're doing stand-up are rendered as gags and jokes.
Right.
But the book is written otherwise. The book is written, you mentioned to me, for someone who might find the book who previously thought that they were all alone, who would find out, oh, there's someone else like me.
Sure. You know, I honestly tried to write a book that didn't have a sincere kernel to it. I mean, it is a sincere work, but I went into it thinking, okay, every book, every drug memoir, every call to emotion of the drug addict memoir has been written. I'm a comic. I have this background, and I want to write something that's fun and funny and points out the dark, horrible, absurdity of the addicted life, especially as a teenager. And I think that to some degree that's definitely present. I think it's a fun and funny read, but it gets dark and sincere of its own design because I found myself going into my own memory bank and thinking to myself, I can't even believe that this stuff happened to me. And by the end of the book, what I love about it, but I think one of the things that works in it is that the humor tricks you. And by the end of the book, you're in quite a dark, quite small, claustrophobic place, which is where I was. And you've been laughing all your way to the bottom. But by the third part of the book, I think we're at a place, I was at a place anyway, emotionally writing it, where it was very scary and very dark and very visceral and real. And that's what it's like. You know, drug addiction and alcoholism at that age is very absurd and silly until it isn't.
I'm curious, though, what's the difference between constructing a joke, and I think that your jokes are carefully written and constructed,
sure,
however casual they may be in presentation, and writing the real story?
Well, as a comic, the challenge that I had as trying to transition into an author is that the first draft I sent to my editor, the notes, every note was less jokes, less jokes, less jokes, because my instinct, my muscle memory as a comedian is to just pack things filled with jokes and jokes and jokes and jokes. And some of them just, you know, distracted you from the narrative of what was happening. So for me, I had to find a way to catch my breath, you know. As a comedian, I am a Gatling gun. You know, that's what I do as a comic. If you look me up and see my stand-up, I talk a mile a minute. I know this sounds like I'm talking a mile a minute, but this is nothing compared to the stage show. And so I had to find a way to catch my breath and go back slowly into my memory and write something that was deliberate, you know?
Does a druggy background help you to pack your sentences so full?
I guess it depends on which drug we're talking about, right? I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I mean, I was, like you said, more or less abducted from New York and stolen away to Oakland, where I was in Oakland Public Schools you know, the rest of my school years. And, you know, it was 85-90% black, and I was one of the very few white kids there. And as a white kid in Oakland, you learn very quickly that there you have to find a way to defend yourself. Is it going to be by retreating inward and becoming a weirdo and hoping, or is it by getting straight A's and hoping to God that you get a scholarship to a private high school? Or, as it was for me, find a way to become a sharp-tongued, you know, smart-ass class clown and make jokes all the time. So my background certainly led to the comic that I am today. Yeah.
And you've talked about how you like to create tension in the room.
Sure.
Tell me about that.
I mean, for me, the most satisfying place to be as a comic is the place right at the edge where the audience loves me, but they could spill over into hating me at any second, you know? And I like that tension. Of course, you know, that's a dangerous place to be because you can push a little bit too far, which I've been guilty of, and find yourself going, all right, I got to reel it back and turn on some of my charismatic, my trademark charisma. Can you hear it right now? Okay. But, I enjoy that process because, you know, I always think of myself as a comic. I think of myself as a musician. If I was a musician, I wouldn't want to be making pop that everybody would jump up and down for. I would want to be making stuff that was challenging. I don't think that of myself as Bob Dylan or anything, but maybe Donovan? No, but I want to be something that's challenging to people, and I think, that's a fun process to watch everybody kind of accept what's happening in the room.
What I loved watching you was that mixture of knowing that you'd gone too far,
sure,
and then smiling charmingly, that there was a mix of seduction and betrayal going on constantly,
right,
in the relation to the audience.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that what I as a comic, one of the things that I try to be cognizant of the fact that there's a relationship, just like you were talking about, that it's not just me giving a performance, but that there are energetic realities in the room. You know, what is this crowd responding to? Where are they? Am I? And it's really about power. And I think that's one of the things that I discovered about myself in writing this book, was that a lot of this, a lot of my childhood was about trying to grab back power because I felt so powerless. And on stage, the whole thing of the whole role of the comedian is to be the charismatic leader, you know, the Kim Jong-il of the room, you know, and making sure that they never see you be weak and that you're in charge and in control. Even when you reveal a weakness, you're not truly revealing a weakness. You're revealing the weakness that you chose to reveal. And I think that is maybe the main difference, is that I am not vulnerable on stage. Even the vulnerability that I present on stage is a manufactured vulnerability. And in writing this book and putting it out to the public, I truly do think that I've showed my soft underbelly to some degree. You know, it's going to be very uncomfortable for me to think about everyone reading this book knowing more about me than my close friends have known about me in the past. So.
I'm talking to Moshe Kasher about his new book, Kasher in the Rye. It's published by Grand Central Publishing. And as an autobiography, it's both the autobiography of a comedian and the autobiography of a child addict. And I'd say that one of the things that goes on when I'm watching you perform is that you're turning your experience into a universal experience. Come on, we all use drugs, we all were children, and we all know that we're all metrosexual now,
sure,
that we're all safely within the realm, black, white, we're all using the same language now.
Right.
But at the same time, I know that you're not as comfortable as I am feeling at ease with all of my subcultures. And I think that you're like a sexy threat to the audience.
I love the sound of that. I'm going to quote you on that. Moshe Kasher, sexy threat.
Well, it's an interesting thing.
Sure.
Because if people are simultaneously gravitating towards you and moving away in their seats.
Right.
And I hope he doesn't notice me. And, oh, gee, I hope he calls me dog.
Right. Sounds like you're talking about my love life.
What is that like?
Drawn close and repulsed quickly. My love life is a wasteland. Let's not talk about it. No, we could talk about it. I think that, you know, my mom was my mom's a Jew, and she played it right according to character arc, you know. She's a wild one and involved in every aspect of my life. You know, I describe it in the book, my mother lived on top of my chest for the first 16 years of my life. That's how I always felt. you know, my mother was sitting on my shoulders every second of every moment of my life. And I know that's not a unique experience. That might be a universal one. But, you know, my mom, tied up in leashes, you know, when I was a kid, because I was such an out-of-control kid. She would sort of leash me up and say, you know, don't run in traffic. And as soon as she undid the leash, literally the leash, I would zoom out into traffic and almost get hit by a car. And, you know, so I think that my love life really is reflective of that leash. I'm still trying to cut that leash. I was born feral, you know. According to my mom, from the very moment, I mean, from that I was born, I was a restless, angry, tumultuous kid. I hit, I screamed, I cried. From the very second I had consciousness, I was fighting.
By the end of this book, you have written to the University of Santa Barbara.
Sure.
Although you haven't been good in algebra, they admit you anyway. You don't get past seventh grade, and then eventually 5 or 6 years later, you take a high school equivalency exam. So there are certain things that you just don't know. So you get to school. When you become aware of what and who you are, how do you shape yourself?
That's an interesting question. How did I shape myself? You know, I think that I've been sort of plunged into the forge of I think that my experiences that I write about in the book and my traumatic childhood are probably a lot more influential on the person that I've become than my intellectual experiences or my performative experiences post-college. You know, college was an interesting experience for me because I recognized that the things that kids were in there experiencing in terms of self-actualization and becoming adults, which is probably the more important part of the college experience, the undergraduate experience anyway, were things that I had already grappled with when I was, you know, 16 years old and in rehab for the third time. You know, I already knew what I was as a person. I already knew my weaknesses and my strengths. And at the same time, they were hyper-developed as compared to me. You know, I was also this six-year-old kid who couldn't figure out how to date and couldn't figure out how to relate to people and couldn't. So I was this, I still to some degree think of myself, for better or for worse, as this kind of bruised peach, you know, this like damaged goods, not in a negative way, but just sort of in a pragmatic way. It's like, this is who I am.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Moshe Kasher about his memoir, Kasher in the Rye. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Moshe Kasher about his new book, Kasher in the Rye, a memoir of a white boy from Oakland who became a drug addict, criminal, mental patient, and then turned 16. Now, at the end of this book, a head of an academy is giving you a copy of Kasher in the Rye to read. Did you have a period when books began to identify you?
Well, you know, yeah, it's interesting. As I said, like when I found drugs and alcohol, I found this way out. And of course, everybody who needs a way out is already looking for it before that. And I would say for sure my first drugs were books as a kid, checking out into fantasy land, you know, reading the Chronicles of Narnia and thinking, oh my God, why can't I find a wardrobe to get out of this tedium of my life, you know? I really could have used a wardrobe back then. And I think that when I was... I dropped all of that when I found this other medicine. You know, I found sugar, and then I found books, and then I found anger and rage and violence, and then I found drugs, and I thought goodbye to everything else, you know. And so when I was 16, like I said, at 16 I got out of my third rehab, and I finally started getting my act together and got back into school. I did, you know, when she handed me that copy of Kasher in the Rye, and she literally sat me in essentially a broom closet for a month and just said, read this, we'll get back to you soon. I was able to just sit in there and be with that book and be with a number of other books at the time and sort of start to get my brain congealing back into normalcy.
Well, I felt that way too. For me, it wasn't Narnia, it was Oz.
Uh-huh.
And my feeling that I just wouldn't have made it in Oz because it would turn out in Oz that if you were secretly bad, you weren't human. Like if you were the witch, you were made out of sugar.
Right.
And that you decompose, and that humans in Oz were given human qualities, like the Tin Man and his heart and the Scarecrow and his brain. But I was sure that I would get there. And I was sure I would get there. And they would find out that I was made of brown sugar like the Wicked Witch, that right. I wasn't going to be one of the good people.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't have made it in Narnia because I'm Jewish, and I don't think they like that there. But I no, but I think that the compelling thing about that Narnia stuff, and in fact about Oz, is and Harry Potter too, is it's all for somebody who has this terrible childhood of trauma and pain. This idea that there is a secret that's right past your grasp that can whisk you out of all of this, and you're meant for greater stuff. And I really thought, when I got a little older, I didn't believe that stuff was going to happen to me. But I did have just as fertile an imagination that somehow just past my grasp of all of this insanity that I was living through, the mental hospitals and arrest and degradation and psychotropic drugs and gang membership and violence and insanity, if I could just continue a little bit further, I would, in fact, find a way out.
But what's so interesting in this book is that even at the time, it seems, you find it funny. And you're the one, even though they're calling you Fatso,
sure.
You're kind of answering back. And as if almost the experience isn't quite real around you. You know, that there's nothing you can say that won't get you too beat up.
Right. I think my entire life has been gallows humor. You know, I was born on the gallows, so I those passages where they're calling me Fatso and Pork Chop, these are my friends, by the way, my best friends. It's incredibly painful, but the muscle memory that I learned from a very young age, being in Oakland Public Schools and being in this insane life, was to find a way to snap back with jokes all the time, jokes, 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 which became this, this edifice of protection, So even if I was crying on the inside, I found a way to be laughing at you on the outside.
Has your mom seen you perform?
Well, yeah, to some degree. I mean, she has. She's seen me on television, and, there's something lost, obviously, with the audio,
That's what I was wondering. Do you sign for her when you perform with her in the office?
No, I'm incredibly selfish, so I won't do that. I don't know. No, my mom, that's a thing that I regret, is that my mom won't ever really get to truly experience what I'm like. But then again, maybe it's good, because I don't need her hearing all of these crass sex jokes, She'd probably be very happy, though. Bravo, you finally learned your lesson.
it seems so spirited to me. And, like a friendly monster. And it didn't seem to me that anyone could take offense. I mean, there's no accounting for mothers.
Sure.
But it seemed that you'd manage to find a way to make yourself playful enough constantly. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if, the hair, the large glasses, the whole thing is part of a statement. I'm funnier than the thing you're taking offense at, so don't waste time with it.
When it's effective, I think that is the message, yeah. I mean, people get offended all the time, but they should all know that I'm just kidding. Just kidding for a living, in fact.
I don't think that that's a good enough answer. I'll tell you why, because I don't think you are kidding. A good deal of the time, you're saying things you want us to believe, but there's something about the rhythm or the smile at the end or the change in vocal inflection that's making it okay. And I feel like you're presenting the audience with a kind of verbal badge, like, you see, if you can laugh at this, you just graduated from square to a tolerant human being. Can you do it with me again? Let's go to this other subject.
Sure.
And now this one.
Well, I like the sound of that. Yeah. I mean, I think I don't attempt to write stuff that's edgy. I just write stuff that's resonant to me, and it ends up being a little bit tough and edgy. And I think that in an ideal situation, the audience and the performer, or the reader and the author, are both getting something out of the experience.
Do you think that there'll be a sequel to Casher in the Rye?
Well, I should hope so. I mean, the book stops at at age 16. I mean, there's not a lot of information about my recovery arc, and I did that very deliberately. I didn't want to write a book where I talked to you about the wonders of what it was like with me getting sober and cleaning up my act and stuff like that. I really wanted this to be a snapshot of a traumatic childhood gone wrong. And it's literally the end of the book is the day that I get sober. You know, I mean, there's a few flash forwards, but really the bulk of the book stops the day that I take a right turn and walk away from my social group. And it sort of leaves it dangling, and it's not, I wasn't setting up a sequel like a Marvel Comics movie, but there's a whole other chapter to my life, which is how I spent my years from 15 till 32 being a young, sober drug addict trying to find a self-identity within this world where, you know, I'm in high school in Oakland and in college and figuring out who I am. So yeah, I think that there's more story to tell, but this is the one that I'm ready to tell now.
Because I still haven't read the book that tells about the alternative comedy world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the addict book, there are others in
sure.
this category, Running with Scissors and things like that. But the book about the young comic, I don't think we've heard the story in a very long time. It was once very fashionable for comedians, Groucho Marx, Harpo Marx, in fact, I think most of the Marx brothers, and all the talk show hosts,
Carl.
To write their books.
Uh-huh.
Karl Marx,
was Carl involved?
The hilarious
yeah.
manifesto.
He was a funny guy, yeah.
With good hair.
Yeah.
And the thing is that I would love to read the book about what it's like to learn stand-up.
Sure,
you know,
right.
How to take it to its max, because it sounds like as a kid you get to do one-liners.
Uh-huh.
On stage, you have to tell the whole story and create it there.
Right, right, yeah. I'll call it, if I write it, I'll call it Take It to the Max with Moshe Kasher, and I'll dedicate it to you.
Oh, you promise?
Yeah, you have my word on that.
Thank you, Moshe.
Yeah.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I've been talking with Moshe Kasher, author, most recently, of Kasher in the Rye, published by Grand Central Publishing. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me in.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Kasher in the Rye at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Alan Howard is associate producer. Connie Alvarez is co-producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Craigor Thine. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm. He is a bookworm. She is a bookworm. We are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.